Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett, and welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I have a special guest with me today. I have Ed Bullion. Ed, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Ed is the founder of VinWiki, V-I-N-W-I-K-I, which is this really cool service that's connecting the automotive community, where the community can collaborate and bring together information on individual cars. And you can go to VinWiki.com to learn more about that. But I very much wanted to talk with Ed because he has this tremendous history with exotic cars, where he's the sales director at Atlanta Lamborghini and has a long car history before that, even working within the auto racing industry. And I know he would have some interesting insight into the reliability of exotic cars. So I thought that since I was tracking him down to have a fun conversation with him, we'd make a podcast episode out of it. And the way I originally found him was he on YouTube has VinWiki Stories, where he and his friends, or say partners in crime, tell these hysterical stories about different escapades with cars. So
for sure. Well, thanks a lot for having me. Yeah, I've certainly had a lot of experience in the long-term ownership and reliability of some interesting cars, so I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah. So I often talk about product balance and product design. And when a product's being designed, the factors I think that come into play right away are, okay, what's the target cost point for a product? What's the time to market? What technology is going to be incorporated and what reliability? And all of those things compete with each other in a design. And so you have brands like Lexus, where clearly they said, okay, reliability is our top part of our brand. So they're not going to push new technology in so aggressively that it compromises reliability. That's their objective. Whereas with exotic cars, generally, they say we want to squeeze every last bit of performance out of this thing, use up all the margins and the latest features and technology in there, but we're willing to compromise reliability. Our customers understand that. That classic, oh, my Ferrari's in the shop, is kind of an assumed condition of having such an amazing car. So from your perspective, Ed, what do you think that, you know, brand identification with the acceptance of the poor reliability has been, and do you think it's changing where these customers are less willing to accept to have poor reliability for extremely high performance?
Well, it absolutely is changing. And the reason that it's changing is how many of them there are. If you look at the number of expensive cars that were sold around the turn of the millennium compared to today, it's about 10x or so. And the explosion of people's willingness to own these cars is mostly based on, in fact, the reliability. Certainly, there are other symptoms like the health of the global economy and the appeal of cars as they're presented on social media and popular car television shows like Top Gear. But a big part of it is just that there are so many more of them sold. And, you know, Ferrari, even in the last few years, has added 50% to their annual production. So as you look at what that means, it means fundamentally we have to make more people comfortable with the routine ownership. I mean, you didn't have people that didn't have gold chains and pet alligators and sold drugs that daily drove Lamborghini Countaches. It was just the market. Now you got plenty of people that don't even know what a Countach is that buy a Huracan.
Yeah.
So as we look at what that means to the marketplace and to people's palate for the reliability standards, it's gone down. You know, the cars have to do better, and they have, with some certain exceptions, obviously, as I'm sure you've noted in some other reliability discussions pertaining to cars. But, you know, for instance, it was 9 months before we had our first real repair order on a Huracan. They were bulletproof.
Wow, really? Yes. Actually, you know, it's interesting. Is that Audi, right? Because Audi bought Lamborghini, course, yeah. Right?
In 98, though. So a long time before 2015. And it began certainly at that point. So, you know, the life cycle of the Diablo was really transformative for Lamborghini. You know, the early 90s cars are tractors. Then you go on, and the late cars, like an 0160 or a late SV, those are pretty good cars to drive. I mean, they're still, you can't see anything, and the dimensions are problematic and everything else, but...
Wait, Ed, you said something, because weren't the original Lamborghinis literally tractors?
Yeah.
Because that was what raised up the story, that Lamborghini was a tractor manufacturer who bought Ferraris, and Ferrari was insulting to him, so he said, I can do better, and he made Lamborghinis.
The clutch on his car kept going out, and so it went to Enzo, and Enzo said, you're just a tractor maker, you're a farmer, I'm not interested in your opinions about my workmanship, and so he said, well, I'll go out and make my own.
Yeah.
And he did, and you know, it's interesting how the two brands have diverged and converged over their life cycles, and so since 1963, when Lamborghini went out and said, I'm going to build a better car, and through today, you know, now... they're exceptionally similar. But for instance, at the point when the Miura came out, the Lamborghini was monstrously more outrageous. So it's been a up and down, and still the production is nowhere close. I mean, for between 2001 and 2010, Lamborghini produced 4,099 Murcielagos. They did about 14,000 Gallardos in that time. But at that same time, Ferrari was producing 15 to 20,000 of each of their mid-engine V8 cars.
Mm-hmm.
So the rarity is very different, and the market that they've been able to achieve and the share in that is obviously significantly different. But now, if you brought an inexperienced car buyer to a McLaren 720S, a Lamborghini Huracan, and a Ferrari 488 with no badging, it might be hard for them to tell. Whereas if they'd heard the history or knew anything about them a while ago, you didn't need anything to be able to tell which one was the Lamborghini, which one was a Ferrari, and which one was a McLaren. So it's a little bit of an interesting world we now live in terms of the choice that's available in the exotic car market. And certainly, yes, that does have significant implications on the reliability.
Yeah. And they also can't use the fact that it's the experience to have the handcrafted kind of crappy, somebody put the badge on sideways or didn't do this right thing, where that used to be, oh, that's part of the character. And if people are going to consider these cars to be something that's not just to show off, but use on a regular basis, that patience for that goes away.
To some extent. At the same time, a hand-built item is not the same as a stamped-out Honda.
Yeah.
So... a lot of people don't understand that even as qualified buyers, you know, they'll come in and expect an Aventador to ride like a Lexus and to be reliable like a Honda. It's $500,000. Why wouldn't it be?
Right.
But those aren't necessarily desirable. You know, when you're talking about something that has a specific output of well over 100 horsepower per liter, you know, it's going to be unreliable.
Yeah.
It just... you know, based on the way we build engines, the way we build cars, that's not how you make them last an awful long time. And so that's been there's a lot of education that has to happen to the audience, the buyers, in order to get them to understand those things.
Yeah. And well, you have that great story of the guy buying the Aston Martins who he bought it, would go home that night. He made a list of like 40 things that were wrong with it, came back the next day furious with his list. So you got him into another one, and you got him. You thought he understood. Hey, this is hand built. It's going to be quirky, and you know, not have the right adjustments and different things. And then he's like, "All right." And you traded for another one, and then he came back the next day with another list of everything that was wrong with it. So it was exactly. Aston Martins, right? That guy was buying.
It was, and then after that one, he bought a Maserati, which I can't imagine ended any better.
God, Maserati, they're such an embarrassment. Don't even get me going on that. I guess any supercar brand that intertwined with Chrysler at one point, but they're so upsetting because they're still grabbing mishmashes of parts in their cars from other locations and things and just slapping it together. It's amazing.
Correct. And the car manufacturers that have any kind of soul or passion or brand identity go through these ups and downs of almost a sine curve of how genuine and authentic they are. So essentially, they build really cool stuff and it breaks because they can't support it. Then they get bought by someone who can, and they take away all the soul, they take away all the identity. then they sell to like a private equity group or somebody, some group of investors that want to bring it back, want to really make something out of it, and it gets back up. And then the same things happen. So the branding, the identity happens in the times where the cars become worse. Because what we really love about cars isn't how mechanically perfect they are. What we love is the experience that they offer. And that's why my favorite car, a Murcielago LP640, is the worst car made lately. But that's why I love it, is that when I drive it, I feel like I'm driving a car. I feel how useless this is in the context of what I'm asking it to do, and how special and evanescent that experience is with respect to my life. Because I know 20, 30 years from now, it won't work on a road. If I'm even allowed to try, it's not going to be workable in the environment that it's demanded to perform in.
Right.
So I love the fact that right now I can take this, you know, 640 horsepower car that I can't see backwards out of, can't go over a transition more than about 3 inches, and can't fit anything in, including my head. I can take it to the grocery store.
Yeah. God forbid somebody ask you to pick them up at the airport. You're like, wait, I got to go home and get my other car.
Exactly. When I pick people up at the airport, the first question is, how large are your bags?
Yeah, right. That's funny, because that's my Datsun. I have my 78 Datsun 280Z with less than 30,000 miles on it. But that car is, to me, is the – exactly. I get in it, and I know I've gone back in time. The smell, the way it shifts, I have to double clutch even though the synchros are newish, you know, like it just, the whole thing, it's time travel, and it's so singular, right? There's no other reason for it other than that experience. Otherwise, it's not even high horsepower, you know, but it feels like you're going a million miles an hour because everything shakes. And it all shook when it came out of the factory that way too.
But, oh, for sure. Yeah. But as you look at the long-term implications of these seasons of unreliability in cars, it's interesting what that does, because it can do a couple of things. So, like, for instance, the reason that you can go out and buy a 2002 to 2007 Maserati for $10,000, yeah, is because they cost $10,000 a year to keep running right.
It's just the ticket to entry into the fair. You know, that's not – you're going to spend all your money on the rides and popcorn and all that, and that's all the maintenance. Yeah, it's horrible.
Right. And but then there's other examples like a McLaren F1 or a Bugatti Veyron or a Mercedes McLaren SLR or a Carrera GT, where the cost of maintenance and the cost of repairs are so significant that it actually stops them from depreciating.
Wait, so how does that work?
Because people who want to buy a car that's a little bit less than how much they are too terrified of what it really costs to maintain them. So if I know that the clutch is $30,000 on a Carrera GT and $8,000 on Gallardo, then that is a factor in whether or not I'm willing to offer just a little bit more to get a Carrera GT. So when Carrera GTs are worth $300,000 rather than the $800,000 they seem to be worth now, part of the reversal was the fact that the people who were marginal cases to buy them as used cars didn't become interested because they were so scared. So advertising them cheaper didn't make them sell. You know, knowing that the tires on a Veyron are $5,500 each, and there's one place in California and one place in France that can properly install them, means that me, as someone who loves the car and could stretch to pay half of what they're worth, I don't try very hard to do that, because I know that even if I did, I couldn't keep it running.
Right. Interesting.
And so when you look at how aspirational the automotive marketplace is for pre-owned exotics, everybody is stretching. My last call was with an exotic car bank talking about how they could achieve better marketing, product penetration, and better branding and awareness of what they do. And that's because there is a huge demand for people who want massive payments on cars that are old, out of warranty, and cost a lot to maintain. And so as we look at how we create that marketplace and how we curate that marketplace, the documentation of what the cars are is really important for educated buying decisions.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because with so many of my customers, you know, in so many different industries, that branding strategy, as you just said, you know, that conversation you just had is so huge. And it's always so you know, in the case of the conversation you just had, the product's been developed and they're talking with you about how to optimize placing it. In a lot of the conversations I have with my customers, they're defining the product. And right. and it's so interesting. One of the biggest tragedies I see, and you in your experiences would kind of see it at the other end, is they come up with a really good definition of all the things that are important for the product to succeed in the target they want. And but then in the development process, they end up with lots of compromises along the way. And what comes out the other end doesn't match that. And then they still try to market it as that original specification. And, you know, there are car examples of that, of successes and failures. I mean, Lexus did not miss it when Toyota wanted to roll out Lexus. They knew that the entire thing was, hey, you know, all you Mercedes and BMW buyers, I know you love your high-end exotic, your high-end, you know, luxury, but we also know that it is annoying that they are not as reliable as a Toyota. So here we are, we can offer you perfect reliability and the luxury. And when they did that and they launched it, they, if there was any customer with an issue, I think like the first 2 years they launched Lexus, they would send a mechanic to your house. You know, and they stuck to that. So that was the plan from the beginning, and they stuck to it. And I know you can probably list 100 examples of where they try. You've seen cars try to be marketed with a specific kind of balance, and they totally missed the mark.
Well, to me, the most interesting example is the most modern manifestation of McLaren road cars, because when the 12C was announced, they'd already obviously been working on this for a few years, and it's as you look now. On the first few years of production, the most obvious thing is that when they started designing and engineering and building this car, they didn't know if they were going to release a P1 level car, a hypercar, or a 12C, a super sports car, because they're built nearly in an identical way with an extremely similar engine. And the most unfortunate output of that, they cost about the same to maintain. So you have a car that costs $250,000 and competes against other $250,000 cars, but it costs three, four, five times as much to operate.
Mm.
Because it really costs what it ought to cost to maintain an $800-900 million car.
Yeah.
And that's been the problem for them in terms of market fit, because they've done that and they've constantly re-engineered in too small an increment. So you go from a 12C to an improved 12C, 12C Spider, to a 650S, 570S, 720S, and all the cars are better than the one before by a very challenging amount of money to identify. And they've had so many massive reliability problems that it makes them really, really hard not only to live with but to sell, because that was obviously my job.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that depreciation curve is so, I mean, even a buyer, you know, buying a new one, you're considering that, right? Because people love, you know, people at that level love to change out their cars. And then to know you're going to take that kind of a, you know, horrible depreciation is, that's hard to think about when you're signing on the dotted line.
Well, and people didn't understand that they were having to create a market share within a market that had existed really since 2004. So prior to that, the exotic car market was all Ferrari, pretty much. Lamborghini was selling 300 cars-ish a year in the U.S. Then you get the Gallardo. They sell a lot of cars. Becomes kind of a two-player market. Maybe you could say some of the Porsches compete, things like that. The Audi R8 comes out, maybe a little bit of market share. But at the end of the day, if you really wanted a halo exotic car, it was those two. 2012, we've got to introduce the 12C, and the Ferrari barely depreciated, and the Lamborghini held its value exceptionally well for a very long time. So the initial depreciation was better on Ferrari. The long-term depreciation was much better for Lamborghini. And who knew what McLarens were going to do? Because everybody who was anywhere interested in buying one was getting marketed to so heavily by the manufacturer that they wanted to buy a new car. They didn't want to buy a one-year-old used one at whatever that might be worth. They wanted the experience, and they bought them. But then we start having these cars come in that are used and starting to have issues. You know, they launched them with none of the navigation working and a lot of the infotainment just complete garbage. And, you know, because, like you say, they had a deadline, they had an idea of what it was supposed to be. And when it wasn't quite that, they still said, send it.
Yeah. So It's so that it's so interesting, and it's amazing how consistent that is across so many industries. Because that's one of the things I'm very grateful for, is I get to see so many different industries, and to see how those program pressures do that. You almost can write the story from the outside by looking at the final product, right? You can that it, and for you, understanding so closely the marketing and the strategies with them too. Things like infotainment, right? Like you, there came a point where that was an amazing thing for a car to have, but then soon after, you kind of had to have it, right? If you're over a certain cost point. And you definitely have to have it when you can buy it in a Honda Civic, right? And these aren't their specialties. These aren't their wheelhouse technologies. They have to contract it out, probably, a lot of that design stuff. Yeah, that's a whole new game, right? And then they put that to a tight schedule. It's a recipe for disaster.
That might actually be my favorite thing about my Murcielago. It has a stick-in Kenwood head unit from the factory. Like, they
Really?
just, it has to have a radio with navigation. So let's just go buy one and
Yeah.
we'll just put it in. Like, who, nobody cares. It's a
Right.
Lamborghini.
Right.
But now that's obviously an unacceptable thing 10 years later. But you're exactly right. And you know, it does create this unbelievably interesting environment and atmosphere as we try to sell the cars. You know, obviously as a salesman, you're sort of beholden to the managerial staff to, you know, perform, sell X number of cars each week, each month, whatever the case may be. And I remember we were having a really, really slow week at one point, and I was like, you know what? I need to sell cars. And at the time, we represented four brands, Lamborghini, Aston Martin, McLaren, and Lotus. And so I decided to have my own little game that week to see if I could get trade assistance to avoid lemon law from the manufacturers on one car from each brand. Because it's obviously not in the best interest of a manufacturer to have a car go to lemon law. And in most states, if you have the same issue 3 times in the first 2 years, if you have a significant safety related issue repeat at all, or if your car is down for more than 30 days, it's subject to having to be bought back by the manufacturer, which brands the title. They're also liable for any taxes, any interest, and any fees that you paid associated with buying or registering the car. So it's a massive liability of manufacturers to sell cars in the US. And it's a big deal. I mean, if you launch a new car company, lemon law can put you out of business. But it's always kind of a part of the discussion in servicing these cars. Like, people say it's a lemon or whatever, like, and it's kind of your job as the first line of defense to manage that and to figure out, like, are we really headed in that direction? Is this a significant enough problem that the manufacturer may end up having to come in and step in and be involved here? Or is it something that can be kind of crisis managed? And so I had customers with each of the brands at that point that were having some real service problems, and we had kind of talked about that. And what manufacturers do to avoid it is called trade assistance. And so they would step in and say, hey, you know, I understand that we might, if this continues, have to buy the car back. We know you're upset. So if we throw in 20 grand to make it easier for you to purchase a new car, would you like to just do that? That gets a new car sold, it keeps the used car from having a branded title, and it relaxes the timeline on the service department to get that car fixed. And so I had a guy with an Aston Martin that had been having this weird transmission problem over and over again. And eventually we found that it was because when the car was manufactured new, when they plugged in one of the sensors for the transmission control unit, they had bent one of the connectors very slightly.
This is your diagnostic donuts, right?
That was a different one,
Oh,
but
okay.
very similar problem. That was with the park, reverse, neutral, drive, and
Oh,
slow buttons.
okay. That's a whole
But
other
that
story.
one took donuts to diagnose. This one had been back and forth between this guy's house in Alabama and our dealership several times. And so I knew that he was getting pretty fed up. And so I got in touch with Aston. That one was pretty easy. The next one was, we got him into a new Vantage. And the next one was an Aventador Roadster. And this guy had an early 13 Roadster. All the 13s were technically dealer demos, but they had terrible transmission problems from the start. You pretty much knew that within the first 300 miles of driving a 2013 Aventador, the car would have to be towed back because it would die and get stuck in third or fifth gear, and there was nothing literally that could be done. You had to take this transmission solenoid out and replace it, and you couldn't do it preemptively because they wouldn't put a recall or a service bulletin out on the car. And so literally, I would just sit around and wait a few days till somebody would reach a few hundred miles, And they'd always call and they would be as mad as a human being can be that just bought a $500,000 car, because they'd be stuck on the side of the road somewhere with everybody taking camera phone pictures of them. So this guy had had actually two transmission failures in this car, and I knew he was close, and I knew the car hadn't depreciated much. So it was definitely in Lamborghini's best interest to kind of let him get a new one. So they did that one pretty easily. The third was the McLaren, and almost any McLaren is technically subject to lemon law, because, you know, in each of these cases, you've got about 7 to 8 days on parts ordering. So if a car gets dropped off on Thursday afternoon, it might not get really written up and evaluated until Monday. Then you got a week to order parts. You're through two weekends. Each real issue is 15 days without breathing hard.
Wow.
And so this car had had a few issues, and this guy, you know, kind of was looking to upgrade and was really mad about having to keep bringing his car in. So I got him a 650S from his 12C Spider. But the next one was Lotus. And Lotus was a little bit hard because Lotus really only made one car at that time, the Evora. And this guy had had so many issues. And there were a lot of build quality issues with Evoras. They would just vibrate and rattle, and the seals wouldn't work, and just everything. And I made a big story about that at one point. But it's this car, he was like, Ed, I think I'm going to lemon law this car because I cannot possibly imagine ever owning a Lotus again. You know, given the circumstance, I'm not saying that I blame you, but let me just talk to them, see what we can do. And I got trade assistance for him to buy an Audi from Lotus. Lotus paid this guy to buy another manufacturer's car.
Wow. Oh, man.
So I got four that week.
That's, that's pretty extreme. That story is probably told within their walls quite often. Oh, my God.
Yeah. All the manufacturers were not interested in hearing from me the week after that.
I'll say. Holy cow. Wow. Well, Ed, thank you so much. I'm so glad you're able to do this episode with me. And,
sure.
Yeah, and I encourage people to check out VinWiki, and definitely VinWiki stories on YouTube if you want to hear some really good fun stories.
That'd be great. Yeah, we've got a great app. We launched it about 2 years ago. It's we call it a social version of Carfax. It's kind of like a way to crowdsource vehicle history. So we let anyone post any information to any car by its VIN or by its license plate. It's a terrific way to document not only the reliability of a car, but just the way that you maintain it, the way you care for it, so that you can build value for it down the road. But then at the same token, if you're a service shop, if you're someone who wants to talk about really what it takes to keep a car going, third-party posts are welcome to any car. So everyone's contributing information so you can really get a clear look at what the car is. And as Adam mentioned, our main marketing initiative is actually the creation of these YouTube stories. So our YouTube channel, VinWiki, keeps getting more subscribers. We really appreciate it. We're just glad people like hearing the content.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's great. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ed. And we'll hope we talk again soon.
I'd love to. Have a great night.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.